Tender is the Night, Disc 5.
25. When he had tottered out, Dick and Rosemary embraced fleetingly. There was a dust of Paris over both of them through which they scented each other. The rubber guard on Dick's fountain pen. The faintest odor of warmth from Rosemary's neck and shoulders. For another half minute, Dick clung to the situation. Rosemary was first to return to reality.
"I must go, youngster," she said.
They blinked at each other across a widening space, and Rosemary made an exit that she had learned young, and on which no director had ever tried to improve. She opened the door of her room and went directly to her desk, where she had suddenly remembered leaving her wristwatch. It was there. Slipping it on, she glanced down at the daily letter to her mother, finishing the last sentence in her mind. Then, rather gradually, she realized, without turning about, that she was not alone in the room. In an inhabited room, there are refracting objects only half noticed. Varnished wood, more or less polished brass, silver and ivory, and beyond these a thousand conveyors of light and shadow, so mild that one scarcely thinks of them as that. The tops of picture frames, the edges of pencils or ashtrays, of crystal or china ornaments. The totality of this refraction, appealing to equally subtle reflexes of the vision as well as to those associational fragments in the subconscious that we seem to hang on to, as a glassfitter keeps the irregularly shaped pieces that may do some time, this fact might account for what Rosemary afterward mystically described as realizing that there was someone in the room before she could determine it. But when she did realize it, she turned swift in a sort of ballet step and saw that a dead Negro was stretched upon her bed. As she cried, "Oh!" and her still unfastened wristwatch banged against the desk, she had the preposterous idea that it was Abe North. Then she dashed for the door and across the hall. Dick was straightening up. He had examined the gloves worn that day and thrown them into a pile of soiled gloves in a corner of a trunk. He had hung up coat and vest and spread his shirt on another hanger, a trick of his own. You'll wear a shirt that's a little dirty where you won't wear a must shirt. Nicole had come in and was dumping one of Abe's extraordinary ashtrays into the wastebasket when Rosemary tore into the room. "Dick, Dick, come and see." Dick jogged across the hall into her room. He knelt to Peterson's heart and felt the pulse. The body was warm. The face, harassed and indirect in life, was gross and bitter in death. The box of materials was held under one arm, but the shoe that dangled over the bedside was bare of polish, and its sole was worn through. By French law, Dick had no right to touch the body, but he moved the arm a little to see something. There was a stain on the green coverlet. There would be faint blood on the blanket beneath. Dick closed the door and stood thinking. He heard cautious steps in the corridor, and then Nicole calling him by name. Opening the door, he whispered, "Bring the coverture and top blanket from one of our beds. Don't let anyone see you." Then, noticing the strained look on her face, he added quickly, "Look here, you mustn't get upset over this. It's only some nigger scrap." "I want it to be over." The body, as Dick lifted it, was light and ill-nourished. He held it so that further hemorrhages from the wound would flow into the man's clothes. Laying it beside the bed, he stripped off the coverlet and top blanket, and then, opening the door an inch, listened. There was a clank of dishes down the hall, followed by a loud, patronizing, "Merci, madame," but the waiter went in the other direction, toward the service stairway. Quickly, Dick and Nicole exchanged bundles across the corridor. After spreading this covering on Rosemary's bed, Dick stood sweating in the warm twilight, considering. Certain points had become apparent to him in the moment following his examination of the body. First, that Abe's first hostile Indian had tracked the friendly Indian and discovered him in the corridor, and when the latter had taken desperate refuge in Rosemary's room, had hunted down and slain him. Second, that if the situation were allowed to develop naturally, no power on earth could keep the smear off Rosemary. The paint was scarcely dry on the Arbuckle case. Her contract was contingent upon an obligation to continue rigidly and unexceptionally as Daddy's girl. Automatically, Dick made the old motion of turning up his sleeves, though he wore a sleeveless undershirt, and bent over the body. Getting a purchase on the shoulders of the coat, he kicked open the door with his heel and dragged the body quickly into a plausible position in the corridor. He came back into Rosemary's room and smoothed back the grain of the plush floor rug. Then he went to the phone in his suite and called the manager-owner of the hotel. "Macbeth, it's Dr. Diver speaking. Something very important. Are we on a more or less private line?" It was good that he had made the extra effort which had firmly entrenched him with Mr. Macbeth. Here was one use for all the pleasingness that Dick had expended over a large area he would never retrace. "Going out of the suite, we came on a dead Negro. In the hall." "No, no, he's a civilian. Wait a minute now. I knew you didn't want any guests to blunder on the body, so I'm phoning you. Of course, I must ask you to keep my name out of it. I don't want any French red tape just because I discovered the man." What exquisite consideration for the hotel! Only because Mr. Macbeth, with his own eyes, had seen these traits in Dr. Diver two nights before, could he credit the story without question. In a minute Mr. Macbeth arrived, and in another minute he was joined by a gendarme. In the interval he found time to whisper to Dick, "You can be sure the name of any guest will be protected. I am only too grateful to you for your pains." Mr. Macbeth took an immediate step that may only be imagined, but that influenced the gendarme so as to make him pull his mustaches in a frenzy of uneasiness and greed. He made perfunctory notes and sent a telephone call to his post. Meanwhile, with a celerity that Jules Peterson, as a businessman, would have quite understood, the remains were carried into another apartment of one of the most fashionable hotels in the world. Dick went back to his salon. "What happened?" cried Rosemary. "Do all the Americans in Paris just shoot at each other all the time?" "This seems to be the open season," he answered. "Where's Nicole?"
"I think she's in the bathroom."
She adored him for saving her. Disasters that could have attended upon the event had passed in prophecy through her mind, and she had listened in wild worship to his strong, sure, polite voice making it all right. But before she reached him, in a sway of soul and body, his attention focused on something else. He went into the bedroom and toward the bathroom. And now Rosemary, too, could hear, louder and louder, a verbal inhumanity that penetrated the keyholes and the cracks in the doors, swept into the suite, and, in the shape of horror, took form again. With the idea that Nicole had fallen in the bathroom and hurt herself, Rosemary followed Dick. That was not the condition of affairs at which she stared, before Dick shouldered her back and brusquely blocked her view. Nicole knelt beside the tub, swaying sidewise and sidewise. "It's you," she cried. "It's you come to intrude on the only privacy I have in the world, with your spread with red blood on it. I'll wear it for you. I'm not ashamed, though it was such a pity. On All Fool's Day we had a party on the Zurich Zee, and all the fools were there, and I wanted to come dressed in a spread, but they wouldn't let me." "Control yourself," So I sat in the bathroom, and they brought me a domino and said, "Wear that." I did. What else could I do? Control yourself, Nicole. I never expected you to love me. It was too late. Only don't come in the bathroom, the only place I can go for privacy, dragging spreads with red blood on them and asking me to fix them. Control yourself. Get up. Rosemary, back in the salon, heard the bathroom door bang and stood trembling. Now she knew what Violet McKisco had seen in the bathroom at Villa Diana. She answered the ringing phone and almost cried with relief when she found it was Collis Clay who had traced her to the diver's apartment. She asked him to come up while she got her hat, because she was afraid to go into her room alone. Book 2. 1. In the spring of 1917, when Dr. Richard Diver first arrived in Zurich, he was 26 years old, a fine age for a man, indeed the very acme of bachelorhood. Even in wartime days, it was a fine age for Dick, who was already too valuable, too much of a capital investment, to be shut off in a gun. Years later, it seemed to him that even in this sanctuary he did not escape lightly, but about that he never fully made up his mind. In 1917, he laughed at the idea, saying apologetically that the war didn't touch him at all. Instructions from his local board were that he was to complete his studies in Zurich and take a degree, as he had planned. Switzerland was an island, washed on one side by the waves of thunder around Gorizia, and on another by the cataracts along the Somme and the Aisne. For once there seemed more intriguing strangers than sick ones in the cantons, but that had to be guessed at. The men who whispered in the little cafes of Bern and Geneva were as likely to be diamond salesmen or commercial travelers. However, no one had missed the long trains of blinded or one-legged men, or dying trunks that crossed each other between the bright lakes of Constance and Neuchâtel. In the beer halls and shop windows were bright posters presenting the Swiss defending their frontiers in 1914. With inspiring ferocity, young men and old men glared down from the mountains at phantom French and Germans. The purpose was to assure the Swiss heart that it had shared the contagious glory of those days. As the massacre continued, the posters withered away, and no country was more surprised than its sister republic when the United States bungled its way into the war. Dr. Diver had seen around the edges of the war by that time. He was an Oxford Rhodes Scholar from Connecticut in 1914. He returned home for a final year at Johns Hopkins and took his degree. In 1916, he managed to get to Vienna under the impression that if he did not make haste, the great Freud would eventually succumb to an aeroplane bomb. Even then, Vienna was old with death, but Dick managed to get enough coal and oil to sit in his room in the Damenstiftstrasse and write the pamphlets that he later destroyed, but that, rewritten, were the backbone of the book he published in Zurich in 1920. Most of us have a favorite, a heroic period in our lives, and that was Dick Diver's. For one thing, he had no idea that he was charming, that the affection he gave and inspired was anything unusual among healthy people. In his last year at New Haven, someone referred to him as Lucky Dick. The name lingered in his head. "Lucky Dick, you big stiff," he would whisper to himself, walking around the last sticks of flame in his room. "You hit it, my boy. Nobody knew it was there before you came along." At the beginning of 1917, when it was becoming difficult to find coal, Dick burned for fuel almost 100 textbooks that he had accumulated, but only as he laid each one on the fire with an assurance chuckling inside him that he was himself a digest of what was within the book, that he could brief it 5 years from now if it deserved to be briefed. This went on at any odd hour, if necessary, with a floor rug over his shoulders, with the fine quiet of the scholar which is nearest of all things to heavenly peace, but which, as will presently be told, had to end. For its temporary continuance, he thanked his body that had done the flying rings at New Haven, and now swam in the winter Danube. With Elkins, second secretary at the embassy, he shared an apartment, and there were two nice girl visitors, which was that, and not too much of it, nor too much of the embassy either. His contact with Ed Elkins aroused in him a first faint doubt as to the quality of his mental processes. He could not feel that they were profoundly different from the thinking of Elkins, Elkins who would name you all the quarterbacks in New Haven for 30 years. And Lucky Dick can't be one of these clever men. He must be less intact, even faintly destroyed. If life won't do it for him, it's not a substitute to get a disease or a broken heart or an inferiority complex, though it'd be nice to build out some broken side till it was better than the original structure. He mocked at his reasoning, calling it specious and American. His criteria of uncerebral phrase-making was that it was American. He knew, though, that the price of his intactness was incompleteness. "The best I can wish you, my child," so said the fairy Blackstick in Thackeray's The Rose and the Ring, "is a little misfortune." In some moods he griped at his own reasoning. Could I help it that Pete Livingstone sat in a locker room tap day when everybody looked all over hell for him? And I got an election when otherwise I wouldn't have got Elihu, knowing so few men. He was good and right, and I ought to have sat in a locker room instead. Maybe I would if I'd thought I had a chance at an election. But Mercer kept coming to my room all those weeks. I guess I knew I had a chance, all right, but it would have served me right if I'd swallowed my pin in the shower and set up a conflict. After the lectures at the university, he used to argue this point with a young Romanian intellectual who reassured him, "There's no evidence that Goethe ever had a conflict in the modern sense, or a man like Jung, for instance. You're not a romantic philosopher, you're a scientist. Memory, force, character, especially good sense, that's going to be your trouble. Judgment about yourself. Once I knew a man who worked 2 years on the brain of an armadillo with the idea that he would sooner or later know more about the brain of an armadillo than anyone. I kept arguing with him that he was not really pushing out the extension of the human range. It was too arbitrary. And sure enough, when he sent his work to the medical journal, they refused it. They had just accepted a thesis by another man on the same subject." Dick got up to Zurich on less Achilles' heels than would be required to equip a centipede, but with plenty, the illusions of eternal strength and health, and of the essential goodness of people. Illusions of a nation. The lies of generations of frontier mothers who had to croon falsely that there were no wolves outside the cabin door. After he took his degree, he received his orders to join a neurological unit forming in Bar-sur-Aube. In France, to his disgust, the work was executive rather than practical. In compensation, he found time to complete the short textbook and assemble the material for his next venture. He returned to Zurich in the spring of 1919, discharged. The foregoing has the ring of a biography, without the satisfaction of knowing that the hero, like Grant, lolling in his general store in Galena, is ready to be called to an intricate destiny. Moreover, it is confusing to come across a youthful photograph of someone known in a rounded maturity and gaze with a shock upon a fiery, wiry, eagle-eyed stranger. Best to be reassuring, Dick Diver's moment now began. 2. It was a damp April day, with long diagonal clouds over the Alpishorn and water inert in the low places. Zurich is not unlike an American city. Missing something ever since his arrival 2 days before, Dick perceived that it was the sense he had had in finite French lanes that there was nothing more. In Zurich, there was a lot besides Zurich. The roofs upled the eyes to tinkling cow pastures, which in turn modified hilltops further up. So life was a perpendicular starting off to a postcard heaven. The alpine lands, home of the toy and the funicular, the merry-go-round and the thin chime, were not a being here as in France with French vines growing over one's feet on the ground. In Salzburg, once, Dick had felt the superimposed quality of a bought and borrowed century of music. Once in the laboratories of the university in Zurich, delicately poking at the cervical of a brain, he had felt like a toy maker rather than like the tornado who had hurried through the old red buildings of Hopkins 2 years before, unstayed by the irony of the gigantic Christ in the entrance hall. Yet he had decided to remain another 2 years in Zurich, for he did not underestimate the value of toy-making, in infinite precision, of infinite patience. Today he went out to see Franz Gregorovius at Daimler's clinic on the Zürichsee. Franz, resident pathologist at the clinic, a Vaudois by birth, a few years older than Dick, met him at the tram stop. He had a dark and magnificent aspect of Cagliostro about him, contrasted with holy eyes. He was the third of the Gregoroviuses. His grandfather had instructed Crepelin when psychiatry was just emerging from the darkness of all time. In personality, he was proud, fiery, and sheep-like. He fancied himself as a hypnotist. If the original genius of the family had grown a little tired, Franz would, without doubt, become a fine clinician. On the way to the clinic, he said, "Tell me of your experiences in the war. Are you changed, like the rest? You have the same stupid and unaging American face, except I know you're not stupid, Dick." "I didn't see any of the war." "You must have gathered that from my letters, Franz." "That doesn't matter. We have some shell shocks who merely heard an air raid from a distance. We have a few who merely read newspapers." "It sounds like nonsense to me." "Maybe it is, Dick, but we're a rich person's clinic. We don't use the word nonsense. Frankly, did you come down to see me or to see that girl?" They looked sideways at each other. Franz smiled enigmatically. "Naturally, I saw all the first letters," he said in his official basso. "When the change began, delicacy prevented me from opening any more. Really, it had become your case."
"Then she's well?" Dick demanded.
"Perfectly well. I have charge of her. In fact, I have charge of the majority of the English and American patients. They call me Dr. Gregory."
"Let me explain about that girl," Dick said.
"I only saw her one time, that's a fact, when I came out to say goodbye to you just before I went over to France. It was the first time I put on my uniform, and I felt very bogus in it. Went around saluting private soldiers and all that." "Why didn't you wear it today?" "Hey, I've been discharged 3 weeks. Here's the way I happened to see that girl. When I left you, I walked down toward that building of yours on the lake to get my bicycle. Toward the cedars. A wonderful night, you know. Moon over that mountain. The Krenzik. I caught up with a nurse and a young girl. I didn't think the girl was a patient. I asked the nurse about tram times, and we walked along. The girl was about the prettiest thing I ever saw. She still is. She'd never seen an American uniform, and we talked, and I didn't think anything about it." He broke off, recognizing a familiar perspective, and then resumed. "Except, Franz, I'm not as hard-boiled as you are yet.
When I see a beautiful shell like that, I can't help feeling a regret about what's inside it. That was absolutely all, till the letters began to come.
It was the best thing that could have happened to her, said Franz dramatically. A transference of the most fortuitous kind. That's why I came down to meet you on a very busy day. I want you to come into my office and talk a long time before you see her. In fact, I sent her into Zurich to do errands.
His voice was tense with enthusiasm.
In fact, I sent her without a nurse, with a less stable patient. I'm intensely proud of this case, which I handled with your accidental assistance.
The car had followed the shore of the Zürichsee into a fertile region of pasture farms and low hills, steepled with chalets. The sun swam out into a blue sea of sky, and suddenly it was a Swiss valley at its best. Pleasant sounds and murmurs, and a good fresh smell of health and cheer. Professor Daumler's plant consisted of three old buildings and a pair of new ones, between a slight eminence and the shore of the lake. At its founding, 10 years before, it had been the first modern clinic for mental illness. At a casual glance, no layman would recognize it as a refuge for the broken, the incomplete, the menacing of this world, though two buildings were surrounded with vine-softened walls of a deceptive height. Some men raked straw in the sunshine. Here and there, as they rode into the grounds, the car passed the white flag of a nurse waving beside a patient on a path. After conducting Dick to his office, Franz excused himself for half an hour. Left alone, Dick wandered about the room and tried to reconstruct Franz from the litter of his desk, from his books and the books of and by his father and grandfather, from the Swiss piety of a huge, claret-colored photo of the former on the wall. There was smoke in the room. Pushing open a French window, Dick let in a cone of sunshine. Suddenly, his thoughts swung to the patient, the girl. He had received about 50 letters from her, written over a period of 8 months. The first one was apologetic, explaining that she had heard from America how girls wrote to soldiers whom they did not know. She had obtained the name and address from Dr. Gregory, and she hoped he would not mind if she sometimes sent word to wish him well, etc., etc. So far it was easy to recognize the tone from Daddy Longlegs and Molly Make-Believe, sprightly and sentimental epistolary collections enjoying a vogue in the States. But there the resemblance ended. The letters were divided into two classes, of which the first class, up to about the time of the armistice, was of marked pathological turn, and of which the second class, running from thence up to the present, was entirely normal, and displayed a richly maturing nature. For these latter letters Dick had come to wait eagerly in the last dull months at Bar-sur-Aube. Yet even from the first letters he had pieced together more than Franz would have guessed of the story.
Mon capitaine, I thought when I saw you in your uniform you were so handsome. Then I thought, je m'en fiche, French too and German. You thought I was pretty too, but I've had that before, and a long time I've stood it. If you come here again with that attitude, base and criminal, and not even faintly what I had been taught to associate with the role of gentleman, then heaven help you. However, you seem quieter than the others. Two, all soft like a big cat. I have only gotten to like boys who are rather sissies. Are you a sissy? There were some somewhere. Excuse all this. It is the third letter I have written you and will send immediately, or will never send. I've thought a lot about moonlight, too. And there are many witnesses I could find if I could only be out of here. Three. They said you were a doctor, but so long as you are a cat, it is different. My head aches so. So excuse this walking there like an ordinary with a white cat will explain, I think. I can speak three languages, four with English. And I'm sure I could be useful interpreting if you arrange such thing in France. I'm sure I could control everything, with the belts all bound around everybody like it was Wednesday. It is now Saturday, and... Four.
You are far away, perhaps killed. Come back to me some day, for I will be here always on this green hill, unless they will let me write my father, whom I loved dearly. Excuse this, I am not myself today. I will write when I feel better. Cheerio. Nicole Warren. Excuse all this. Captain Diver, I know introspection is not good for a highly nervous state like mine, but I would like you to know where I stand. Last year, or whenever it was in Chicago, when I got so I couldn't speak to servants or walk in the street, I kept waiting for someone to tell me. It was the duty of someone who understood. The blind must be led. Only no one would tell me everything. They would just tell me half, and I was already too muddled to put two and two together. One man was nice. He was a French officer, and he understood. Two. He gave me a flower and said it was plus petit et moins entendu. We were friends. Then he took it away. I grew sicker, and there was no one to explain to me. They had a song about Joan of Arc that they used to sing at me, but that was just mean. It would just make me cry, for there was nothing the matter with my head then. They kept making reference to sports, too, but I didn't care by that time. So there was that day I went walking on Michigan Boulevard, on and on, for miles, and finally they followed me in an automobile, but I wouldn't get three in. Finally, they pulled me in, and there were nurses. After that time, I began to realize it all, because I could feel what was happening in others. So you see how I stand. And what good can it be for me to stay here with the doctors harping constantly in the things I was here to get over? So today, I have written my father to come and take me away. I am glad, for you are so interested in examining people and sending them back. It must be so much fun. And again from another letter. You might pass up your next examination and write me a letter. They just sent me some phonograph records in case I should forget my lesson, and I broke them all so the nurse won't speak to me. They were in English, so that the nurses would not understand. One doctor in Chicago said I was bluffing, but what he really meant was that I was a twin six, and he had never seen one before. But I was very busy being mad then, so I didn't care what he said. When I am very busy being mad, I don't usually care what they say, not if I were a million girls. You told me that night you'd teach me to play. Well, I think love is all, too, there is or should be. Anyhow, I am glad your interest in examinations keeps you busy. Tout à vous, Nicole Warren. There were other letters, among whose helpless caesuras lurked darker rhythms. Dear Captain Diver, I write to you because there is no one else to whom I can turn, and it seems to me if this farcical situation is apparent to one as sick as me, it should be apparent to you. The mental trouble is all over, and besides that, I am completely broken and humiliated, if that was what they wanted. My family have shamefully neglected me. There's no use asking them for help or pity. I have had enough, and it is simply ruining my health and wasting my time pretending that what is the matter with my, too, head is curable. Here I am in what appears to be a semi-insane asylum, all because nobody saw fit to tell me the truth about anything. If I had only known what was going on like I know now, I could have stood it, I guess, for I am pretty strong. But those who should have did not see fit to enlighten me. 3. And now, when I know and have paid such a price for knowing, they sit there with their dogs' lives and say I should believe what I did believe. Especially one does, but I know now. I am lonesome all the time, far away from friends and family across the Atlantic. I roam all over the place in a half daze. If you could get me a position as interpreter, I know French and German like a native. Fair, four, Italian, and a little Spanish, or in the Red Cross ambulance, or as a trained nurse, though I would have to train you would prove a great blessing. And again, since you will not accept my explanation of what is the matter, you could at least explain to me what you think, because you have a kind cat's face, and not that funny look that seems to be so fashionable here. Dr. Gregory gave me a snapshot of you, not as handsome as you are in your uniform, but younger looking. Mon Capitaine, it was fine to have your postcard. I am so glad you take such interest in disqualifying nurses. Oh, I understood your note very well indeed. Only I thought from the moment I met you that you were different. Dear Capitaine, I think one thing today and another tomorrow. That is really all that's the matter with me, except a crazy defiance and a lack of proportion. I would gladly welcome any alienist you might suggest. Here they lie in their bathtubs and sing, "Play in your own backyard," as if I had my backyard to play in, or any hope which I can find by looking either backward or forward. They tried it again in the candy store, again, and I almost hit the man with the weight, but they held me. I'm not going to write you any more. I'm too unstable. And then a month with no letters. And then, suddenly, the change. I am slowly coming back to life. Today the flowers and the clouds. The war is over, and I scarcely knew there was a war. How kind you have been. You must be very wise behind your face like a white cat, except you don't look like that in the picture Dr. Gregory gave me. Today I went to Zurich. How strange a feeling to see a city again. Today we went to Bern. It was so nice with the clocks. Today we climbed high enough to find asphodel and edelweiss. After that the letters were fewer, but he answered them all. There was one. I wish someone were in love with me, like boys were ages ago, before I was sick. I suppose it will be years, though, before I could think of anything like that. But when Dick's answer was delayed for any reason, there was a fluttering burst of worry, like a worry of a lover. Perhaps I have bored you, and afraid I have presumed, and I keep thinking at night you have been sick. In actuality, Dick was sick with the flu. When he recovered, all except the formal part of his correspondence was sacrificed to the consequent fatigue, and shortly afterward the memory of her became overlaid by the vivid presence of a Wisconsin telephone girl at headquarters in Bar-sur-Aube. She was red-lipped like a poster, and known obscenely in the messes as the switchboard. Franz came back into his office feeling self-important. Dick thought he would probably be a fine clinician, for the sonorous or staccato cadences by which he disciplined nurse or patient came not from his nervous system, but from a tremendous and harmless vanity. His true emotions were more ordered and kept to himself. "Now, about the girl, Dick," he said. "Of course I want to find out about you and tell you about myself, but first about the girl, because I have been waiting to tell you about it so long." he searched for and found a sheaf of papers in a filing cabinet, but after shuffling through them, he found they were in his way and put them on his desk. Instead, he told Dick the story. 3. About a year and a half before, Dr. Daumler had some vague correspondence with an American gentleman living in Lausanne, a Mr. Devereux Warren of the Warren family of Chicago. A meeting was arranged, and one day Mr. Warren arrived at the clinic with his daughter Nicole, a girl of 16. She was obviously not well, and the nurse who was with her took her to walk about the grounds while Mr. Warren had his consultation. Warren was a strikingly handsome man, looking less than 40. He was a fine American type in every way, tall, broad, well-made, un homme très chic, as Dr. Daumler described him to Franz. His large gray eyes were sun-veined from rowing on Lake Geneva, and he had that special air about him of having known the best of this world. The conversation was in German, for it developed that he had been educated at Göttingen. He was nervous and obviously very moved by his errand. Dr. Daumler, my daughter isn't right in the head. I've had lots of specialists and nurses for her, and she's taken a couple of rest cures, but the thing has grown too big for me, and I've been strongly recommended to come to you. Very well, said Dr. Daumler. Suppose you start at the beginning and tell me everything. There isn't any beginning. At least, there isn't any insanity in the family that I know of on either side. Nicole's mother died when she was 11. And I've sort of been father and mother both to her, with the help of governesses. Father and mother both to her. He was very moved as he said this. Dr. Daumler saw that there were tears in the corners of his eyes, and noticed for the first time that there was whiskey on his breath. As a child, she was a darling thing. Everybody was crazy about her. Everybody that came in contact with her. She was smart as a whip, and happy as the day is long. She liked to read or draw or dance or play the piano, anything. I used to hear my wife say she was the only one of our children who never cried at night. I've got an older girl, too, and there was a boy that died, but Nicole... He broke off, and Dr. Daumler helped him. She was a perfectly normal, bright, happy child. Perfectly. Dr. Daumler waited. Mr. Warren shook his head, blew a long sigh, glanced quickly at Dr. Daumler, and then at the floor again. About 8 months ago, or maybe it was 6 months ago, or maybe 10, I tried to figure, but I can't remember exactly where we were when she began to do funny things, crazy things. Her sister was the first one to say anything to me about it, because Nicole was always the same to me, he added rather hastily, as if someone had accused him of being to blame. The same loving little girl. The first thing was about a valet. Oh, yes, said Dr. Daumler, nodding his venerable head, as if, like Sherlock Holmes, he had expected a valet, and only a valet, to be introduced at this point. I had a valet, been with me for years. Swiss, by the way. He looked up for Dr. Daumler's patriotic approval. And she got some crazy idea about him. She thought he was making up to her. Of course, at the time, I believed her, and I let him go, but I know now it was all nonsense. What did she claim he had done? That was the first thing. The doctors couldn't pin her down. She just looked at them as if they ought to know what he'd done, but she certainly meant he'd made some kind of indecent advances to her. She didn't leave us in any doubt of that. I see. Of course, I've read about women getting lonesome and thinking there's a man under the bed and all that. But why should Nicole get such an idea? She could have all the young men she wanted. We were in Lake Forest, that's a summer place near Chicago where we have a place, and she was out all day playing golf or tennis with boys, and some of them pretty gone on her at that. All the time Warren was talking to the dried old package of Dr. Domler, one section of the latter's mind kept thinking intermittently of Chicago. Once in his youth, he could have gone to Chicago as fellow and docent at the university, and perhaps become rich there, and owned his own clinic instead of being only a minor shareholder in a clinic. But when he had thought of what he considered his own thin knowledge spread over that whole area, over all those wheat fields, those endless prairies, he had decided against it. But he had read about Chicago in those days, about the great feudal families of Armour, Palmer, Field, Crane, Warren, Swift, and McCormick, and many others. And since that time, not a few patients had come to him from that stratum of Chicago and New York. "She got worse," continued Warren. "She had a fit or something. The things she said got crazier and crazier. Her sister wrote some of them down." He handed a much-folded piece of paper to the doctor. "Almost always about men going to attack her, men she knew or men on the street, anybody." He told of their alarm and distress, of the horrors families go through under such circumstances, of the ineffectual efforts they had made in America, finally, of the faith in a change of scene that had made him run the submarine blockade and bring his daughter to Switzerland. "On a United States cruiser," he specified with a touch of hauteur. "It was possible for me to arrange that by a stroke of luck, and may I add," he smiled apologetically, "that, as they say, money is no object."
"Certainly not," Domler said dryly.
He was wondering why and about what the man was lying to him. Or, if he was wrong about that, what was the falsity that pervaded the whole room? The handsome figure in tweeds sprawling in his chair with a sportsman's ease. That was a tragedy out there in the February day. The young bird with wings crushed somehow. And inside here, it was all too thin. Thin and wrong.
"I would like to talk to her a few minutes now," said Dr. Domler, going into English as if it would bring him closer to Warren.
Afterward, when Warren had left his daughter and returned to Lausanne, and several days had passed, the doctor and Franz entered upon Nicole's card. Diagnosis: divided personality. Acute and downhill phase of the illness. The fear of men is a symptom of the illness and is not at all constitutional. The prognosis must be reserved. And then they waited with increasing interest as the days passed for Mr. Warren's promised second visit. It was slow in coming. After a fortnight, Dr. Domler wrote. Confronted with further silence, he committed what was for those days une folie, and telephoned to the Grand Hotel at Vevey. He learned from Mr. Warren's valet that he was at the moment packing to sail for America. But reminded that the 40 francs Swiss for the call would show up on the clinic books, the blood of the Tuileries guard rose to Dr. Domler's aid, and Mr. Warren was got to the phone.
"It is absolutely necessary that you come. Your daughter's health all depends. I can take no responsibility."
"But look here, doctor, that's just what you're for. I have a hurry call to go home." Dr. Domler had never yet spoken to anyone so far away, but he dispatched his ultimatum so firmly into the phone that the agonized American at the other end yielded. Half an hour after this second arrival on the Zurichsee, Warren had broken down, his fine shoulders shaking with awful sobs inside his easy-fitting coat, his eyes redder than the very sun on Lake Geneva. And they had the awful story.
"It just happened," he said hoarsely. "I don't know. I don't know. After her mother died, when she was little, she used to come into my bed every morning. Sometimes she'd sleep in my bed. I was sorry for the little thing. Oh, after that, whenever we went places in an automobile or a train, we used to hold hands. She used to sing to me. We used to say, "Now, let's not pay any attention to anybody else this afternoon. Let's just have each other." Or, "This morning you're mine." A broken sarcasm came into his voice. People used to say what a wonderful father and daughter we were. They used to wipe their eyes. We were just like lovers. And then all at once, we were lovers. And 10 minutes after it happened, I could have shot myself, except I guess I'm such a goddamned degenerate I didn't have the nerve to do it.
"Then what?" said Dr. Daumler, thinking again of Chicago and of a mild, pale gentleman with a pince-nez who had looked him over in Zurich 30 years before.
"Did this thing go on?"
"Oh, no, she seemed to freeze up right away. She'd just say, 'Never mind, never mind, Daddy. It doesn't matter. Never mind.'"
"There were no consequences?"
"No."
He gave one short, convulsive sob and blew his nose several times.
"Except now there are plenty of consequences."
As the story concluded, Daumler sat back in the focal armchair of the middle class and said to himself sharply,
"Peasant."
It was one of the few absolute worldly judgments that he had permitted himself for 20 years. Then he said,
"I would like for you to go to a hotel in Zurich and spend the night and come see me in the morning."
"And then what?"
Dr. Daumler spread his hands wide enough to carry a young pig.
"Chicago," he suggested.
Four.
"Then we knew where we stood," said Franz.
"Daumler told Warren we would take the case if he would agree to keep away from his daughter indefinitely, with an absolute minimum of 5 years. After Warren's first collapse, he seemed chiefly concerned as to whether the story would ever leak back to America. We mapped out a routine for her and waited. The prognosis was bad. As you know, the percentage of cures, even so-called social cures, is very low at that age." "Those first letters looked bad," agreed Dick. "Very bad, very typical. I hesitated about letting the first one get out of the clinic. Then I thought it will be good for Dick to know we're carrying on here. It was generous of you to answer them." Dick sighed. She was such a pretty thing. She enclosed a lot of snapshots of herself. And for a month there I didn't have anything to do. All I said in my letters was, "Be a good girl and mind the doctors." That was enough. It gave her somebody to think of outside. For a while she didn't have anybody, only one sister that she doesn't seem very close to. Besides, reading her letters helped us here. They were a measure of her condition. I'm glad. You see now what happened?
She felt complicity.
That's neither here nor there, except as we want to revalue her ultimate stability and strength of character. First came this shock. Then she went off to a boarding school and heard the girls talking. So from sheer self-protection, she developed the idea that she had had no complicity. And from there it was easy to slide into a phantom world where all men, the more you liked them and trusted them, the more evil. Did she ever go into the horror directly?
No.
And as a matter of fact, when she began to seem normal, about October, we were in a predicament. If she had been 30 years old, we would have let her make her own adjustment. But she was so young, we were afraid she might harden with it all twisted inside her. So Dr. Daumler said to her frankly, "Your duty now is to yourself. This doesn't by any account mean the end of anything for you. Your life is just at its beginning," and so forth and so forth.
She really has an excellent mind. So he gave her a little Freud to read, not too much, and she was very interested. In fact, we've made rather a pet of her around here, but she is reticent, he added. He hesitated. We have wondered if in her recent letters to you, which she mailed herself from Zurich, she has said anything that would be illuminating about her state of mind and her plans for the future. Dick considered. Yes and no. I'll bring the letters out here if you want.
She seems hopeful and normally hungry for life, even rather romantic. Sometimes she speaks of the past as people speak who have been in prison, but you never know whether they refer to the crime or the imprisonment or the whole experience. After all, I'm only a sort of stuffed figure in her life. Of course, I understand your position exactly, and I express our gratitude once again. That was why I wanted to see you before you see her.
Dick laughed. You think she's going to make a flying leap at my person?
No, not that, but I want to ask you to go very gently. You are attractive to women, Dick.
Then God help me. Well, I'll be gentle and repulsive. I'll chew garlic whenever I'm going to see her and wear a stubble beard. I'll drive her to cover.
Not garlic, said Franz, taking him seriously. You don't want to compromise your career, but you're partly joking.
And I can limp a little, and there's no real bathtub where I'm living anyhow.
You're entirely joking, Franz relaxed, or rather assumed the posture of one relaxed.
Now, tell me about yourself and your plans.
I've only got one, Franz, and that's to be a good psychologist. Maybe to be the greatest one that ever lived.
Franz laughed pleasantly, but he saw that this time Dick wasn't joking.
That's very good, and very American, he said. It's more difficult for us.
He got up and went to the French window.
I stand here and I see Zurich. There is the steeple of the Grossmünster. In its vault, my grandfather is buried. Across the bridge from it lies my ancestor, Lavater, who would not be buried in any church. Nearby is the statue of another ancestor, Heinrich Pestalozzi, and one of Dr. Alfred Escher. And over everything there is always Zwingli. I am continually confronted with a pantheon of heroes.
Yes, I see, Dick got up. I was only talking big. Everything's just starting over. Most of the Americans in France are frantic to get home, but not me. I draw military pay all the rest of the year if I only attend lectures at the university. How's that for a government on the grand scale that knows its future great men? Then I'm going home for a month and see my father. Then I'm coming back. I've been offered a job.
Where?
Your rivals. Gisler's clinic on Interlaken.
Don't touch it, Franz advised him. They've had a dozen young men there in a year. Gisler's a manic depressive himself. His wife and her lover run the clinic. Of course, you understand that's confidential.
How about your old scheme for America? Asked Dick lightly. We were going to New York and start an up-to-date establishment for billionaires.
That was students' talk.
Dick dined with Franz and his bride and a small dog with a smell of burning rubber in their cottage on the edge of the grounds. He felt vaguely oppressed, not by the atmosphere of modest retrenchment, nor by Frau Gregorovius, who might have been prophesied, but by the sudden contracting of horizons to which Franz seemed so reconciled. For him, the boundaries of asceticism were differently marked. He could see it as a means to an end, even as a carrying on with a glory it would itself supply. But it was hard to think of deliberately cutting life down to the scale of an inherited suit. The domestic gestures of Franz and his wife as they turned in a cramped space lacked grace and adventure. The post-war months in France and the lavish liquidations taking place under the aegis of American splendor had affected Dick's outlook. Also, men and women had made much of him, and perhaps what had brought him back to the center of the great Swiss watch was an intuition that this was not too good for a serious man. He made Käthe Gregorovius feel charming, meanwhile becoming increasingly restless at the all-pervading cauliflower, simultaneously hating himself, too, for this incipience of he knew not what superficiality. God, am I like the rest after all? So he used to think, starting awake at night. Am I like the rest? This was poor material for a socialist, but good material for those who do much of the world's rarest work. The truth was that for some months he had been going through that partitioning of the things of youth wherein it is decided whether or not to die for what one no longer believes. In the dead white hours in Zurich, staring into a stranger's pantry across the upshine of a street lamp, he used to think that he wanted to be good. He wanted to be kind. He wanted to be brave and wise. But it was all pretty difficult. He wanted to be loved, too, if he could fit it in. Five. The veranda of the central building was illuminated from open French windows, save where the black shadows of stippling walls and the fantastic shadows of iron chairs slithered down into a gladiola bed. From the figures that shuffled between the rooms, Miss Warren emerged first in glimpses and then sharply when she saw him. As she crossed the threshold, her face caught the room's last light and brought it outside with her. She walked to a rhythm. All that week there had been singing in her ears, summer songs of ardent skies and wild shade. And with his arrival the singing had become so loud she could have joined in with it. "How do you do, Captain?" she said, unfastening her eyes from his with difficulty as though they had become entangled. "Shall we sit out here?" She stood still, her glance moving about for a moment. "It's summer, practically." A woman had followed her out, a dumpy woman in a shawl, and Nicole presented Dick. "Signora—" Franz excused himself, and Dick grouped three chairs together. "The lovely night," the signora said. "Muy bella," agreed Nicole. Then to Dick, "Are you here for a long time?" "I'm in Zurich for a long time, if that's what you mean." "This is really the first night of real spring," the signora suggested. "To stay?" "At least till July." "I'm leaving in June." "June is a lovely month here," the signora commented. "You should stay for June and then leave in July when it gets really too hot." "You're going where?" Dick asked Nicole. "Somewhere with my sister. Somewhere exciting, I hope, because I've lost so much time. But perhaps they'll think I ought to go to a quiet place at first. Perhaps Como. Why don't you come to Como?" "Ah, Como," began the signora. Within the building, a trio broke into Zuppe's light cavalry. Nicole took advantage of this to stand up, and the impression of her youth and beauty grew on Dick until it welled up inside him in a compact paroxysm of emotion. She smiled, a moving, childish smile that was like all the lost youth in the world. "The music's too loud to talk against. Suppose we walk around. Buenas noches, signora." "Good night. Good night." They went down two steps to the path, where in a moment a shadow cut across it. She took his arm. "I have some phonograph records my sister sent me from America," she said. "Next time you come here, I'll play them for you. I know a place to put the phonograph where no one can hear." "That'll be nice." "Do you know Hindustan?" she asked wistfully. "I'd never heard it before, but I like it. And I've got Why Do They Call Them Babies? And I'm Glad I Can Make You Cry. I suppose you've danced to all those tunes in Paris." "I haven't been to Paris." Her cream-colored dress, alternately blue or gray as they walked, and her very blonde hair dazzled Dick. Whenever he turned toward her, she was smiling a little, her face lighting up like an angel's when they came into the range of a roadside arc. She thanked him for everything, rather as if he had taken her to some party, and as Dick became less and less certain of his relation to her,
her confidence increased. There was that excitement about her that seemed to reflect all the excitement of the world. "I'm not under any restraint at all," she said. "I'll play you two good tunes called Wait Till the Cows Come Home and Goodbye, Alexander." He was late the next time, a week later, and Nicole was waiting for him at a point in the path which he would pass walking from Franz's house. Her hair drawn back of her ears brushed her shoulders in such a way that the face seemed to have just emerged from it, as if this were the exact moment when she was coming from a wood into clear moonlight. The unknown yielded her up. Dick wished she had no background, that she was just a girl lost with no address save the night from which she had come. They went to the cache where she had left the phonograph, turned a corner by the workshop, climbed a rock, and sat down behind a low wall, facing miles and miles of rolling night. They were in America now. Even Franz, with his conception of Dick as an irresistible Othario, would never have guessed that they had gone so far away. They were so sorry, dear. They went down to meet each other in a taxi, honey. They had preferences and smiles, and had met in Hindustan. And shortly afterward, they must have quarreled, for nobody knew and nobody seemed to care. Yet finally, one of them had gone and left the other crying, only to feel blue, to feel sad. The thin tunes, holding lost times and future hopes in liaison, twisted upon the valet night. In the lulls of the phonograph, a cricket held the scene together with a single note. By and by, Nicole stopped playing the machine and sang to him. "Lay a silver dollar on the ground and watch it roll because it's round." On the pure parting of her lips, no breath hovered. Dick stood up suddenly. "What's the matter? You don't like it?" "Of course I do. Our cook at home taught it to me. A woman never knows what a good man she's got till after she turns him down. You like it?" She smiled at him, making sure that the smile gathered up everything inside her and directed it toward him, making him a profound promise of herself for so little. For the beat of a response, the assurance of a complementary vibration in him. Minute by minute, the sweetness drained down into her out of the willow trees, out of the dark world. She stood up too, and stumbling over the phonograph, was momentarily against him, leaning into the hollow of his rounded shoulder. "I've got one more record," she said. "Have you heard So Long, Letty? I suppose you have." "Honestly, you don't understand. I haven't heard a thing." "Nor known, nor smelt, nor tasted," he might have added. "Only hot-cheeked girls in hot secret rooms. The young maidens he had known at New Haven in 1914 kissed men saying, 'There,' hands at the man's chest to push him away. Now, there was this scarcely saved waif of disaster bringing him the essence of a continent."
This ends Disc 5.